This is James Corbett, and joining me today on the Corbett Report is Kevin Annette, formerly an ordained minister of the United Church of Canada. In 1992, he began his ministry at St. Andrew's United Church in Port Alberni, British Columbia. When he began asking uncomfortable questions about the church's relationship to the local Native community, he opened a Pandora's box that has led him on a nearly two-decade quest for the truth. This quest ultimately led to his delisting by the United Church and has spurred him to write a book, Hidden from History, the Canadian Holocaust, produce an award-winning documentary, Unrepentant, Kevin Annette and Canada's Genocide, and launch the Hidden from History website at hiddenfromhistory.org. Mr. Annette, thank you very much for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Thank you.
Well, I think there's no way to adequately summarize your experience over the past two decades in a trite introductory bio. So I think it would be instructive for my listeners who are hearing this story for the first time if you could go over the process by which you uncovered the genocide that took place with the complicity of the church and the state in the Canadian residential school system. How did you start to uncover this harrowing story?
Well, for me, it really began as a minister and the work I was doing every day in Port Alberni. The neighborhood around the church was probably filled, half the people in that area were Native. Yet you never saw any of them working in the stores or coming to the churches. It was a very segregated kind of community. And I began to get to know these people, and I learned on the ground the suffering they were all going through. And invariably, it was because of the history of having been in the residential schools and suffered tremendously because of it. I began to have to do funerals, for example, of a lot of Native kids who had died, teenagers who had killed themselves. I found the death rate was 10 to 20 times the national average and the local Native community. All of that began to raise question marks for me. But, you know, as a member of the so-called white society in Canada, I was very isolated from the truth of what had happened. And it was only after people began to talk specifically about killings they'd witnessed in the local residential school that I began to learn that there was a much bigger history behind all that. But for me, it happened in stages. It wasn't an immediate discovery. And it was from the eyewitnesses coming forward, really. They were the ones who began to educate me about the real history.
Yes. Well, once again, no short summary could ever do justice to something of this magnitude. But tell us, as you started to investigate this story and you delved deeper into the sordid history of both the church and the government as they participated in this genocide, who are some of the survivors that you met, and what types of stories were they telling you?
Well, to give you a real, the best example is the first Native family I ever really met. I went out to marry them. They were living right on the grounds of the old Alberni Residential School, which was run by the United Church for over 50 years. And when I was, after I performed the wedding, we were sitting there talking, and I asked, his name is Danny Gus, who's a retired Native fisherman, and I asked him why that he and other Natives weren't coming to the church, because I knew that a lot of them had been associated with the United Church. And he looked at me, and he finally said, well, they killed my best friend in that school, and he's buried in the hills out back, and none of the church people want us around. They know all about it. So, you know, I began to hear those stories, eyewitnesses who knew about these killings, who knew about the children suffering so much. You know, and later, years later, when I was, after I'd been fired from the church and I was working on my PhD at the university in Vancouver, I began to uncover these documents which showed that half the children were dying every year in these residential schools. So all of those things were indicating to me that, these weren't just stories that people were making up. It was a whole history that had been suppressed. And the church that I was working for was a key actor in that whole thing.
It certainly was, according to the documents that you've uncovered, and obviously there were repercussions to the information that you were digging up. How was your questioning received by those around you, both within the church and within the local Native community?
Well, you know, the people in the church, when I first began to ask questions, their attitude, this is either church officials, fellow clergy, or my fellow churchgoers, they were all saying the same thing, and that was they're making it up. This isn't true. The Native people resent us for having come here, and so they're just saying anything they can to make us look bad. It was a flat denial. That was years before the lawsuits had begun against the church and the government brought by the survivors of these schools. So the church felt free to simply deny the whole thing, and I was warned in no uncertain terms that if I kept looking into that my job would be at stake. I was issued that kind of warning by several officials in the United Church before I was actually fired. So it's obvious that they were very upset and concerned about this stuff coming out. But, you know, within the Native community, of course, there was no denial. There was a complete, awareness of the stuff, and they were very scared about talking about it. And it took a lot of, it actually took me getting fired and then beginning to work with more survivors on the ground when they began to open up. I guess after I had lost my job, they trusted me more because I wasn't associated with the church. And they began to tell me more of the details at that point.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, you got some of your information from the survivors themselves, but also some from your research as when you were a PhD candidate at UBC. Tell us about some of the documentary evidence that you uncovered for the genocide that was taking place.
Well, after I got fired, I'd been in Port Alberni almost 3 years, and I was fired, summarily fired without cause or notice. And after that, and I couldn't get work, the church wasn't allowing me to work anymore, I started a PhD at University of BC, as I mentioned. That same year, in 1996, they had acquired a lot of the records of the residential schools, and I began to go through these things. And it was quite amazing because they had a lot of firsthand evidence there, letters from Indian agents and even people in the church describing the very large number of deaths, records of sterilization programs that had been operating on the West Coast in the Indiana hospitals here, and even a report from a Dr. Peter Bryce early in the 20th century, a doctor from Indian Affairs who found that the children were dying en masse in these schools because of a regular practice by the staff of taking healthy children and housing them with children dying of tuberculosis and then never treating them. So in effect, they were deliberately spreading these deadly diseases among the children and then letting them die. And that's what accounted for the huge death rate of over 50%. So all of that evidence began to uncover that at the university, but also from other sources, people beginning to come forward and share stuff with me because they had my firing at the church had made the news. The people were aware of the fact that the church was very much trying to silence me. And they began to come forward with that. So it was really a process of staying public and continuing to dig for this information.
Well, stepping back for a moment, for those listeners who might not be aware of this history, tell us a little bit about the Canadian residential school system and how it came into existence.
Well, it was really, there had been mission schools among Native people for, early into the, as far back as the early 1800s. But in the late 1800s, the Canadian governments officially authorized a lot of the mission schools operating among Native people, especially in the West. And around 1890, these schools began to set up. It was a law in Canada that every Native child who was 7 years or older had to go to these boarding schools or their parents would go to jail. So, by the early 20th century, there was over 150 of these schools, run about two-thirds of them by the Roman Catholic Church, the other schools run by the Anglican and United Church of Canada. And something like a quarter of a million children went through these schools and half or more never came back. Those schools continued right up to the 1980s. The last one closed in 1996. And so, a lot of the perpetrators are still alive. And as much as the government and the media here have tried to portray this issue as one of, it's in the past and there's been an apology and compensation, the issue is much, much bigger than that because it involves intentional genocide, an attempt to wipe out, entire nations of people under the guise of religious education. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, the history I began to stumble across. And I mentioned earlier about the when I was fired in early 1995, what was interesting was I had been talking about this from my pulpit and letting people speak, but the issue that actually got me fired was that I found out that the church had been basically selling off the land that had been they had stolen from Native people, selling that off to various logging companies for kickbacks to church officers, and I had written to the church about that and had been summarily fired. And it was only when I continued to talk about that and the residential school deaths that the church then took the step to actually throw me out of the church altogether. So again, it was proven that by this that the church was simply trying to cover up a very sordid history.
Well, certainly genocide is probably the strongest charge that could be leveled against any government or state actor. What do you think is the basis for that charge, rather than simply putting this up to neglect or abuse?
Well, there was a plan in place, clearly, to kill off Aboriginal people. And, you know, it's not only in the comments that politicians have made over the years, but kind of inherent in the entire Indian Act and in the policy of government and churches in Canada, just like in the United States, there was the understanding that Native people had to either convert to Christianity or they were expendable. And that was demonstrated in a lot of statements which are in my book and in the film Unrepentant. But also, just the proof in the actual numbers, we know that in a period of about the last three decades of the 1800s on the West Coast here in British Columbia, most of the Native communities fell by over 90%. Their population, they were completely decimated by smallpox and tuberculosis. And we have numerous eyewitnesses who have described the practices of the delivery of smallpox-laden blankets, of, you know, people who witness children being housed in dormitories where they're all dying of tuberculosis and never treated, and the sterilization programs, which were quite widespread all over the West Coast. Right here in Nanaimo, where I live on Vancouver Island, there was a hospital, the Nanaimo Indian Hospital, where eyewitnesses describe, you know, children and women especially being regularly sterilized and subject to medical experiments and that. So all of that shows, as is defined in the United Nations Convention on Genocide, it all indicates an intent to destroy, you know, a people. And by all the criteria of that Convention on Genocide, Canada and its churches are guilty of genocide.
There comes a time in encountering this information in which I think everyone has to step back and just ask the simple question, why? Why did these nightmares take place? And obviously to raise the specter of genocide is to talk about something orders of magnitude more than just neglect or abuse. There must be some sort of motivating ideology behind something like this.
Well, I think there was two factors. One was simply a desire to get the lands and resources. And like in many places in the world, the way you do that is to drive off, destroy, and then marginalize the indigenous population, the people who occupy the lands and resources. That was clearly, you know, a main motive for all this. But even more basically, in the very ideology of the cultures that conquered here in North America, there's this Cherokee scholar called Steve Newcomb, and he describes the ideology as what he calls Christian superior dominion. And that is the idea that Christians, and the church in particular, are superior to other people in the world and have the right to take their land. This was enunciated in papal laws as far back as the 1400s. There's a very infamous one called Romanus Pontifex, which the Pope passed in 1452, the Intercatera Bull of 1494. These were laws that said non-Christians do not have the right to their own land, and Christian kings have the duty and the right to go in and take those lands from the non-Christian, what they called pagans and Saracens. And every European nation passed those kinds of laws, which basically said Christians have the obligation to go in and make those people Christian and take their land from them, because they don't have the right. They're not even considered people under the law because they're not Christian. So it's a combination of that economic motive of empire and the religious imperialism of Christendom, which combined to cause this massive genocide. As a matter of fact, here in North America, it was the largest mass murder of people in human history, yet a lot of Canadians and Americans still can't get their mind around the fact that it was genocide.
Well, certainly, as I'm sure you've come across during your research, at the time that the residential school system was being established and as the genocidal institutions started grafting themselves onto the native populations in this tyrannical overlay, the pseudoscience of eugenics was booming in the civilized Western world, with the ideas of racial hygiene and social Darwinism and forced sterilization. Can you speak to what such junk sciences and racist ideologies do to the mindset of someone who wants to believe that their total control over others is actually a benefit to society as a whole?
Well, I think it's all pervasive, and it's not even something, because it's kind of a water we swim in, and we're taught from day one. We're not even aware we're propagating that ideology. You know, there's a very good book that's been written about this called War Against the Weak by Edwin Black, and it's subtitled America's Plan to Create a Master Race. And it looks at the origin of the eugenics philosophy in the United States in the latter 1800s, And it was basically the idea that, well, the human race, as you mentioned, is divided into various races, and the so-called Anglo-Saxon people are at the apex of that pyramid. And we have to protect ourselves against so-called racial defilement. This is the language that the early eugenicists and Adolf Hitler used. There was a common language on both sides of the Atlantic. And the idea was, well, we have to perfect ourselves by not only getting rid of so-called inferior races, but those within our own race who are, quote, defective, like mentally defective people, people morally unfit, like unwed mothers, political dissidents, people like that, all of those people should be stopped from breeding. And that was the ideology behind the eugenics movement. It manifested in a lot of laws in the United States and Canada, which allowed any group targeted to be involuntarily sterilized. There was over 40 states in America passed sterilization laws aimed primarily at what they call the feeble-minded, people with a lower IQ. But it was broadened. In Canada, the sterilization laws were broadened to include Native people, other racial groups, you know, as I mentioned, people deemed morally or politically undesirable. And it was widely used against Native people. And to give an example, over one-third of all Native people in Alberta over one-third of the people sterilized in Alberta hospitals were Aboriginal, even though they were only 2% of the population. On British Columbia, there were three hospitals set up here by the United Church and the federal government and the Catholics to target Native people who were traditionalists, that is, who were still living on their land, who refused to become Christian, and who were chiefs, the traditional leadership of the indigenous communities. They were all targeted for sterilizations, and these sterilizations continue today through vaccination programs and other ways of, under the guise of public health. Definitely these chiefs' families are still being targeted. So, in other words, it's an ideology that doesn't stop. It just changes its rhetoric, but the aim is really the same.
Well, expand on that for a moment. What do you mean that it's still continuing under the guise of vaccination programs, for example?
Well, to give an example, one of the men interviewed in our film, Steve Sampson, he's a descended here on Vancouver Island, in the mid-area of Vancouver Island, there's the people here were known as the Cowichan Nation. And Steve Sampson is a traditional Cowichan chief. His family were forced off their land by the Catholic missionaries, displaced, and in the 1980s, both of his sons were abducted, basically arrested under the false charges, and put in foster homes. And from there, they were sent to the Victoria General Hospital, where they were both given vasectomies. And there was no other rationale for that besides the fact that Steve Sampson and his family were traditional chiefs, and that they were the enemies of the local band council, which is a government-funded Native group that really administers the Indian Act and the genocide on behalf of the Canadian government. Well, those kinds of stories are being repeated all across Canada. I've actually documented dozens of stories of people who continue to face that. There was a Native woman who was about to charge the United Church with killing her sister, and I don't want to mention her name over the air right now because her lawsuit is pending, but in 1987, she was told by the Social Welfare Agency in Vancouver, as a Native woman, that if she wanted to see her children again, they were living in white foster homes, if she wanted to see them, she had to agree to be sterilized, to have her tubes tied. And she agreed to that in order to see her children again. So this use of sterilization is something that welfare agencies and the government continue to use all the time.
In the Unrepentant documentary, you stated quite correctly, I think, that there is no healing that can be done after genocide has taken place. And in articles like What Does an Apology Mean to Harry Wilson on hiddenfromhistory.org, you talk about the Harper government's apology for the treatment of children in residential schools, which the Prime Minister delivered last June. And ultimately, you conclude that an apology isn't going to make any difference to the lives of the people like Harry Wilson and other residential school survivors who will never forget what they and those around them were subjected to for most of the formative years of their life. Again, I think you're quite correct in this, but it does ultimately beg the question of what does motivate you in this quest for the truth? What are you seeking to accomplish?
Well, for me it started with a very basic question of what is my relationship going to be with people who my culture wronged and tried to destroy? As a minister, I was obligated to these people. As somebody who was trying to do the moral thing, I felt the need to confront my culture about what they had done and continued to do to Native people and others. After a while, I realized that, no, the culture of the perpetrator of crimes is not going to hold itself accountable. It's going to do what it does now, which is basically issue verbal apologies to basically indemnify themselves from legal action and try to hope that the whole thing will blow away. Well, at one point you realize, okay, they may not, you know, the winners of a war may not be willing to hold themselves accountable, but they can be exposed. The truth can still be known. And we can bring a lot of pressure to bear on them to continue to disclose more and maybe even to be held accountable in some way someday. One of the ways I think they are going to be held accountable is not through their own court system, but through, for example, Aboriginal courts of justice, which are now being set up on traditional territories. Some of the hereditary chiefs are saying, okay, we're not going to get justice in the white courts. We'll set up our own courts and try, you know, we'll name these perpetrators who are still alive and we'll bring them in and try them under traditional codes of justice. So people learn to take action into their own hands when the systems of state and church are set up really to protect the perpetrators and to try to silence the eyewitnesses, and that's still going on. So, you know, I think there are ways of fighting back that people are creating, but as a person who is a member of the society that did it, I continue to feel the need to bring out the truth about this and hold up my own people accountable for what they did.
Tell us about your speaking tour to disestablish genocide.
Well, in starting in March and then actually continuing through to the summer, I've got a number of areas in North America where I'm going to speak, all through the United States and Canada, where I'll be speaking with survivors of residential schools and also in public lectures showing our film to try to broaden the whole issue here. In Canada, if we're talking about, you know, the need to stop genocide and what's caused it, we have to challenge the institutions that did it and disestablish them. So one of the movements that people are trying to create here is actually a movement to establish something called the Republic of Ganata, where we sever ties with the British Crown, we disestablish these state-run churches, and we bring about justice directly with people. You know, in Canada, the Crown, the so-called Crown, owns all the land. And that imposes a lot of economic slavery on a lot of people. And we have to start to try to disestablish that. So this is a means to try to broaden the whole issue, put it on a broader political basis, if you like, and say, you know, you're not going to stop this genocide from happening just by a bit of money and apology. We have to challenge the very ideology and the institutions that caused it. And that's really what the purpose of it is.
Well, we certainly do have to challenge all of those systems of tyrannical control, and I do support you in your efforts. Mr. Annette, I know that ultimately your life, too, has been scarred by even coming into contact with this information, and I think that you've suffered a great personal toll for having taken up this quest, and I want my listeners to go to the website and watch the documentary and read the book and learn about some of the things that Kevin Annette has gone through to attempt to bring this information to light. And I think ultimately no one can come away from this topic without being affected by it. So that's why it's important to get behind this work, to get it into the public and begin the societal discussion of it. So how can people find out more about you and your work and support you in your campaign?
Well, thanks, James, for saying that. I appreciate it. My website is www.hiddenfromhistory.org, and my email is hiddenfromhistory@yahoo.ca. I'd be happy to hear from anyone if they'd like to contact me. My number is 250-753-3345, and that's right on the west coast of Canada. And if you'd like to book me in to come and speak, I'd be happy to do that. But, you know, like I say, I welcome any contact from people.
Mr. Annette, if my listeners could just come away from this conversation with one thought, one realization, one understanding about the genocide of Canada's Native population, what would you wish them to take away today?
Creation program to bring home the remains and give the kids a proper burial. You know, that's the first thing. This involves innocent children that died en masse, and the people who killed them are still haven't been held accountable. Not one person has ever gone to trial in Canada for the death of a child in a residential school, even though more than 50,000 children died in these schools over a century. So I would say keep in your mind the fact that this is about human beings. Don't take anything at face value and continue to try to work with people who are bringing the truth out about this.
Kevin Annette, thank you once again for joining me today on The Corporate Report, and thank you for all of your work.
Thank you, James.